Hey, everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping, too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
I got stuff for you.
Holy moly.
I need to get some snakes and release them around my house.
But I love eating people. I love eating kids.
These guys are the scientists of the supernatural, lecturers leaving lessons for inquiring laymen. They are applying the scientific method to a world that baffles science. They are the cryptids of the corn.
Every day that you open your mouth,
I know, right?
I'm more convinced that you're abducted by aliens.
No.
And it just stood up. I mean, it just like kept going and going. And she goes, what the?
These are idiots.
I was laughing reading this because I already knew how you would feel.
Idiot. What part of the story fits your balloon?
Well,
this isn't a UFO. Yeah.
But who else has big black wings and red eyes?
Batman.
Well, Mothman.
Oh, yeah, Mothman.
Well, everyone, I think we know exactly what it is. So say it all with me. It was the Sandhill Crane.
Would you try it?
No.
You wouldn't eat it?
No.
Why?
Because they're probably toxic.
There'd be a lot of poop in my pants. I've seen a 6-foot alligator go swinging through the air and slam into a tree.
Welcome back to Cryptids of the Corn Podcast. I'm a great power mystery.
Oh my gosh, you sound like...
Whenever I go full cult leader, that'll be the voice.
Oh man, I'm J-Clone 19, and you sound like this sports... I can't think of the guy's name. He's Scott something. He's a sports radio announcer, and he has the worst voice ever, and I don't know why he's on radio, because he sounds like you just did, right? I can't even do it without hurting
my
throat.
I thought that was a joke.
No,
I'm really coughing.
I tried to get the full-on rasp, and it just hurt my throat.
Mm. All right, so... Front of house stuff, super, super fast. Live shows. We have one in April in Arkansas. We have one in June in Ohio in Ada. April, Drunken Cryptids. Get your tickets below. Come out. The tickets are selling fast. So coming out. And in June, who is it with?
Michael Thompson, famous author.
And it's all about sea monsters and UFOs. So that's in Ada. You can get your tickets below, guys.
Our hometown.
Mm-hmm. Frogman Fest is our next festival. You want to come out and get a t-shirt or a book or whatever? There you go.
And speaking of which, the book. You can find the book at our website, Crypts of the Corn, cryptsofthecorn.com.
I was like,
under the book tab. That's right. I was mixing both those thoughts.
All right. I still need hometown legend stuff. Like if you have a hometown with ghosts, cults, paranormal activity, UFO crashes, monsters, it's your guys' local stuff. I need more. So please. Please send me more.
And if you like everything you're hearing and you want to hear more, please join our Patreon or our member space on our website. That's cryptsofthecorn.com. You go to the member space or to patreon.com/cryptsofthecorn.
I prefer you use Patreon, but if you don't like Patreon, there is the member space.
Right.
All right. So this whole episode, I don't really know what to call it. So I have everything from animal intelligence again, I guess is the kind of the big topic we're going to talk about today. And why this is important for cryptids and stuff like that, for the cryptids that are animals or more animal-like, a big question we get asked a lot is, well, how do these things hide? How do these things move around people? You know, they seem to have human-like intelligence and stuff like that. As humans, we have a problem with recognizing intelligence in other species.
Okay.
So a couple of new things have happened. New studies have come out at the end of 2024 and the beginning of 25, where we really start pushing the boundaries and understanding intelligence level in our known animal kingdom, okay, let alone the unknown. So this is why this, I think, is important for this. The first one's a big one. AI helps humans have a 20-minute conversation with a humpback whale named Tiwin. Tiwin? Tiwin is, I guess, Tiwin?
All right.
Tiwin. So this AI, so we've talked about humpback whales, you know, specifically on the show a ton. Humpback whales are hyper-intelligent beings. They have really, really hyper-developed language. By that, I mean, they have names, they have surnames, they have family names. They have greetings, they have calls. We've identified around 14,000 characters in their language.
Dang.
So characters are like words.
Okay.
So they're very, very adept at speaking. So we've known this for a while, though. We've known that they've had a very developed language. Now, here's the problem, is that we have not been able to have a conversation with these animals because you have to recognize what the call is. So what are they saying?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to push buttons to respond.
In real time.
In real time. So it's very hard to keep a whale engaged.
Okay.
Because they're waiting a long time. Nothing's happening. So they're like, all right, I get bored.
Then they're out of there.
And then they're out of there. So what we used to do, and before we really understood this, play whale calls back when we thought it was a much more simpler language.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd record a whale from somewhere else and just play the sound back. And you'd get some results, but it's more of interest of like, well, what's, you know, it'd be like us here in the woods or the words in the woods. I don't like that. There's nobody here.
Yeah, that's something that doesn't seem right. Mm-hmm. Uncanny Valley.
So in this remarkable encounter off the coast of Alaska, human scientists had what they described as a full conversation with a humpback whale. Dr. Brianna McCowan of the University of California, Davis, was at the heart of this unexpected exchange. The doctor and her team were on what's known as whale SETI. They have been studying how humpback whales communicate. They are aiming to understand whale communication.
SETI a ship, I'm guessing?
Huh?
Is whale SETI a ship?
So SETI is the search for extraterrestrial life.
Right.
So this is whale SETI.
Okay.
So they are aiming to understand whale communication systems to help them search for life beyond Earth.
Oh. Oh, okay.
So this is, they're using whales because they know they have a complex language. So using whales to kind of help us if we deal with complex life off the planet, of how we're going to talk to them.
Oh, okay.
So they're using this specifically to study what we already know is an intelligent animal that has a developed language.
How to communicate with something else with
intelligence.
Yeah, that's not us that's intelligent. Okay. Yes.
So whales respond to a human greeting. Using the underwater speaker, the team played a recording of a humpback whale contact call, basically the hello, to the astonishment, Tiwani approached the boat and began responding. For about 20 minutes, the whale circled them, matching the intervals between each call that they played. We believe this is the first such communication exchange between human and humpback whales and the humpback language, says the doctor. The researchers were thrilled by such direct interaction using the whale's own signs back. So before I continue, basically what the AI part was doing was recognizing what the word was that the whale was saying, or the phrase, or, you know, the sentence, and putting together through their massive data bank a respond back.
Yes, a respond that actually makes sense.
In real time. So this was able to keep the whale engaged for well over 20 minutes.
Wow.
Which is the first time it's ever happened. Whales have been lured in by, you know, blasting calls, but never this kind of stuff.
Never had a back and forth exchange. Yeah.
So the science behind the encounter, the whale SETI team was working to develop filters to detect intelligent signals. This could be the search, this helps to search for extraterrestrial life. By studying the whale communication, they hope to find patterns that they can apply to signals in outer space. So basically what they're saying is whales have advanced language, but they don't speak like we do. You know, they're speaking in frequencies above, below, long, you know, all kinds of different things. Tons of stuff we can't even hear or perceive.
Right. Yep.
So they're using this to kind of basically make an AI that can filter through and look for these things.
And fill in those gaps that we can't. Yeah.
For extraterrestrial life. Dr. Fred Sharple, the Alaskan Whale Foundation, emphasizes just how intelligent humpback whales are, pointing out to their complex social system and unique behaviors. They create tools such as nets, using bubbles to catch fish, and extensively communicate through songs and social calls, says the doctor, Sharp. Human whales and extraterrestrial life. The behavior is observed by Tiwani supports the important idea in the search for extraterrestrial life. Because of current limitations of technology, an important assumption for search for extraterrestrial intelligence is that extraterrestrials will be interested in making contact, so they target human receivers, noted the doctor.
Hmm.
The important assumption is certainly supported by the behaviors of humpback whales. By engaging with whales, the team believes they can learn how to direct and detect and understand intelligent signals, whether they come from the depths of the ocean or the far reaches of space. The detail of the extraordinary encounter is published in the journal Appear J and is an article titled Interactive Bioacoustic Playback as a Tool to Detect and Explore Non-Human Intelligences, Conversation with an Alaskan Humpback Whale. The researchers plan to use mathematics in various forms of artificial intelligence, specifically in form theory and mechanic learning, to measure how complex the whale's communication is. This is the understanding of the rule and structures of this message received. Making sense so far?
Oh, yeah.
So now we're getting to the depth. This AI is also picking up of how intelligent or how complex the whale sentence structure is.
Okay.
Which is, as we'll find out, very, very complex.
It's grammar.
Yes. Better than mine. Humans and whales take the next step, but the whale study team isn't stopping there. They're preparing another paper focusing on non-audio ways humpback whales might communicate, such as using bubble rings when they make around humans. So humpback whales will actually make these bubble nets.
I've seen this before.
Yeah, that's how they hunt.
That's so pretty awesome. It's tool use. Okay.
It does classify as tool use. So they are actually what we say, if you were looking at a human development, it's past the Stone Age.
Okay.
They don't have hands, so they're not, but they are still using tools. They're making tools to their own ability. They're blowing bubbles in these nets to concentrate fish. So these, humpback whales, as far as technology, would go to be around the Stone Age.
Okay.
So they're more advanced than most apes. So co-authors, Dr. Josie Hubbard, Lisa Walker, Jody Ferdinand, bring expertise in animal intelligence, whale song analysis, and whale behaviors to the project. The team acknowledges the financial support of the Templin Foundation Diversity Intelligence Programs, which help make the research possible. So whale study is short for whale search of extraterrestrial life.
Mm-hmm.
So Star Trek.
What do you mean?
You remember, was it Star Trek II, the movie, where this giant probe comes back from space and was looking for humpback whales?
Oh, no, I don't know.
All right. So basically, this giant death probe came back and was using humpback whales as the metric for Earth sustainability. So when they come back, humpback whales have been extinct for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Okay.
So they go back in time to steal a pair of humpback whales so they don't get destroyed by this giant death probe.
Gotcha.
So they bring a pair back.
Okay. So it is like the opposite or like the inverse.
Well, the aliens were communicating with humpback whales.
Right. Exactly.
Because humpback whales are much more intelligent than us.
Yeah.
So when they came back, they're like, where'd the whales go?
Gotcha. All right,
dirty apes, get ready to wipe you off the planet.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, we'll get you some whales. We'll find you some whales. Whale search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a unique project that combines marine biology and the quest for life beyond Earth.
Hmm.
Isn't this weird?
This is kind of strange.
The research are trying to decode whale communication, like I said, working under the idea that these sounds might contain extremely complex messages similar to human language. So, like I said, there's people on this that are whale biologists, and there's people that aren't. Whale biologists are like, yes, they have extreme complex communication systems.
Right.
And the people that aren't are like, okay, what do you mean? Like, what's a complex?
Right, yeah.
No, they have a full language. They have a full language. Yeah, so any questions?
I mean, I guess I got plenty, but...
So this is a part of the SETI Institute that searches the search for extraterrestrial life. This is an extension of that.
Oh, wow, okay.
So we talk about SETI on here a lot.
Yep. Yep, so they do have a connection, I guess, together. It's not just a name.
No, it is. It is Whale SETI. Mm. It is a subdivision of SETI, the actual official SETI.
A phenotype.
There you go. Subdivision. Like I said, humpback whales are highly, highly intelligent. They're one of the few mega mammals that have bounced back. And some scientists argue that they're actually pre-whaling numbers now.
Oh, wow.
Pre-commercial whaling numbers. But that's mostly because most of the other whales are not doing good. So there's a lot of available space.
I just thought the whaling people were doing the numbers now.
Oh, yeah, that could be too.
Yeah, guys, look.
The Japanese whaling fleet are like, yeah, don't worry.
We have a surplus of whales now.
Yeah. Gosh, don't get me even started on that.
Look at these numbers.
No, so, yeah, so officially talked for 20 minutes. And they think it's because the AI was still learning why this conversation was a little short.
Okay.
Or the other thought is that Tiwani got nervous because he'd never seen another whale.
Yeah.
Because he was circling around the boat the whole time. So he was talking. They had a full conversation. It started with greetings and moved on to like just literally formal talking that these whales will do. Tiwani is a lone bull, which they will communicate. So bulls, generally what they'll do is they don't swim with pods and they don't hang out with pods of the females and the calves because they're so much bigger than the females and the calves.
Okay.
They're resource training.
I was going to say they'd be competing for resources. Yeah.
So okay. They kind of go off on their own to help the females and the calves not be, you know, so straggling for resources. But they're generally speaking close enough that where if problems occur, they can come in and help.
Okay.
So they stay within listening distance, which for them is, you know, 50, 60 miles.
Right.
Pretty accurately.
Yeah.
Yeah, blue whales can talk over 1,000 miles.
So it's gigantic. It's just crazy.
But yeah, so they think that one of the things is that the AI may have still been learning and maybe said the wrong things and just, you know, the whale got bored or it was starting to not make sense to the whale.
That's why I was going to lean more towards that. Just it knows where the sound's coming from, obviously. And then it's just seeing the ship there. It probably thought the whale was on top of the ship. Like maybe they're going to lure him in now.
Or it got bored because it never seen the whale.
Right, yeah.
And it just, you know.
It might, or it just got put off.
Yeah, just a little nervous.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on.
Stuff's not adding up here.
But yeah, so these guys are massive. 60, 65 foot long, 40 to 50 tons. They can travel up to 5,000 miles in 1 year between their breeding ground and their feeding ground.
Which whale in particular?
Humpbacks.
Humpbacks, okay.
Yeah. Oh, and they're not even big for whales.
No. I mean, they're pretty average.
I mean, they're big. I mean, they're the size of a house.
Right. For whales, though.
Yeah, but for their group. Yeah, so what do you think?
So this is the first time we've done it. I mean, I got...
Full interspecies communication,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Which I think it's very significant. I think it's a moment in history that should be remembered. Part of my brain also sees like the scary negative side of this.
What's the scary negative? I'm curious.
So my thoughts are, you know, if it's AI... artificial intelligence talking to them, you know.
And they did, in the article, they did correct it with the true, where they said machine learning.
Okay.
So we've talked about that a lot, that we really don't have AI. We don't have true AI.
Well, right. What we consider is AI.
What people say is AI.
Sure.
Because it's machine learning.
Yeah.
There's no really intelligence in the device they're using. It doesn't know what the machine doesn't know what it's doing. It's matching. A person still had to go through and write the code.
Mm-hmm.
You match this to this.
Mm-hmm.
When this sound comes up, you do this sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of fills in the gaps as best as it can.
Right. But we know the limit or the capabilities of that technology and what we got access to now, the public even. So we know in private, you know, it's even more significant. But where I see where it can be negative is, you know, if we allow machine learning to... not just govern us, but, you know, make decisions for us or on our behalf.
That'd be bad.
And then not on top of that, if these things can not just communicate with these things being this machine learning technology, not only communicate with us, but if it can now communicate with the animal kingdom, we start with whales, but then it goes down to everything. If it's able to communicate and, I don't know, manipulate the natural world, like animals?
You're really not going to like the next article.
Oh, no. Oh, gosh.
So this is kind of a hodgepodge. You're the ones just putting us on this page, and I'm glad you did, because I was going to do it as a freaky phone on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much more with the cryptids and the aliens and everything like that. Are you literally using this to find aliens?
Oh, man. The AI? Mm. Or the whales? Or the whale technology?
They're using the whale technology to help, because space is noisy.
Right.
Whether people understand that or not. So it's really hard to tell. If you've, there's a SETI game you can play. It's called Signal. Our signal simulator. Sorry, signal simulator.
Okay.
Where you're in one of the SETI bases with the giant radio telescopes.
Yeah.
And you're trying, analyzing signals and like, oh yeah, that's a planet's background noise. That's a sun. You know, that's whatever. And it gets a little creepy. It's supposed to make you feel creepy. It's supposed to make you feel creeped out because space is noisy. So this is actually, they're developing this to look for certain patterns of what is intelligent communication.
Okay. I just had a random thought.
Non-human intelligent communication, because it's our best example we have.
Absolutely.
On the planet. Yeah. You know? So basically they can take it to the SETI radio telescopes and kind of have, like, put a filter on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't be any more accurate. It'll be a little more accurate, I guess, by like, okay, here's noises that fit, that seem to have patterns, that seem to have these kind of language markers. And they probably could still be stars just, you know, burping up radiation that happen to be in a pattern. But you're getting rid of the ones that are just all scrambly.
Gotcha.
Because the AIs don't know. They're just looking for sounds in space.
Right. But who's going to say at a certain point it will? What if it does figure that out and it can unscramble it, basically? And then you point it up at some planet Mars and it's like, death, murder.
Well, that's the goal.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're saying to us. That would be... Well,
yeah, I mean, then we'd just give the whale the microphone. All right, talk to him.
Right, fix this.
Calm him down.
Yeah. Oh, speak on our behalf. Come on, make this better.
But yeah, no, there's a whole Star Trek thing. That's a whole Star Trek episode that, and I'm getting that wrong for any of our Star Trek like super fans. I'm getting it roughly right. That, you know, this giant death probe wanted whales
as like the marker, the canary in the coal mine.
Well, they talked to whales last time they were there.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when they came back, humans had killed all the whales, and they were not happy.
Disclosure.
They were not happy.
It's all soft disclosure.
No, so this is, I thought it was pretty cool, but it shows the intelligence of the whales. And it's funny to me that there's still big chunks of the scientific community that are like, well, that really doesn't prove anything about their intelligence.
Hmm. Interesting. What
the old fuddy-duddies.
What's intelligence then?
Exactly. Well, I got some more on here that this is all about intelligence, this whole episode.
This does make me think of, though, like Family Guy, like moving forward, you know, Brian the dog.
Mm-hmm.
How far away are we from that? Not saying like
now,
not like the alcoholic, dog.
The communication with the dog.
Where he's just
talking
to you.
We're not far away from it.
Yeah.
We're not far away from it. Nobody's looking into it.
Oh, somebody's definitely is.
No, I mean, but like this, like the, you know, it takes decades of research first just to categorize subtleties in language.
Okay.
So they've been doing that with the whales since the 1980s, at least.
Okay.
And so it took 20 or 30 years to get a catalog built up enough.
Yeah.
To really be like, okay, we think that these what these words mean.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing, is you have to, just because you hear the word or the phrase repeatedly in the language doesn't mean, another Star Trek reference, the telepath lady, I can't remember her name, but she's like, holds up a glass of water.
Yeah, what is her
name? And she says, what does that word mean? And she's pointing to the glass of water and says the word, ah. And for that language, does that mean glass? Does that mean water? Does that mean transparent? Does that mean liquid?
It's like being the miracle worker.
Right. So just because you got the word.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of guess what the word means. But there's still a lot. So why whales, humpback specifically, they've been doing it forever.
Uh-huh.
So there's been, you could do it with dogs too, easily.
But sure.
You have to do that though. You have to put that forward.
Right.
Because you have to get over the rough meanings of things.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get to the the subtleness.
What was that lady's name, the miracle worker? You remember her name?
No.
The one, you know what I'm talking about, though?
Mm-mm.
The one that helped Helen Keller learn.
I don't know anything about what you're talking about.
Helen Keller was a deaf.
I know who Helen Keller is.
Oh, okay. She, like, taught her language, basically, taught her to communicate, and then Helen Keller started writing books and stuff as she got older, which is crazy, but she's deaf and blind. But somehow the miracle worker taught her how to speak, because I don't know, but that's what they should name this after. That's what it should be called.
I don't even know her name.
Yeah, me either. Maybe I should look that up.
All right.
I'll look that up now while you're...
Ready for the next thing we're going to talk about?
Yes.
So you are worried... So here's what I'd be worried about with the AIs and given and talking to whales is the opposite. Is whales using the AI
back
to get rid of us?
Oh, gosh.
If any species has a right to wipe humans off the planet, whales are up there.
Reverse engineer our stuff.
Whales are up there.
Yeah.
Intelligent, caring beings that we burnt them down to oil. We burn them so much that in the Antarctic ice sheet, it looks like a volcanic eruption.
Yeah.
You know,
I'd imagine they would turn, they'd flip the
script. I don't think they would. They're pretty chill, but I'm just saying if any organism deserves the right to do such.
It's whales.
It's whales. I do think the country of Japan would just slough off into the ocean, though.
Oh, probably. For reasons.
Oh, the Japanese government is still just absolutely murdering whales by the hundreds.
Yes, today.
The Japanese government is probably the sole reason the blue whale will be extinct in the next 20 years.
Yeah. Just sit in that moment for a minute. Just sit in that
Not
moment.
The Japanese people, the Japanese government.
Government. Oh, yeah.
Commercial the whaling for industry. Sure.
The governments around the world are in
bad.
Bad, yes. And miracle worker lady, his name is Ann Sullivan.
Ann Sullivan, this one's to you.
Yep.
All right. Robot placed under control of a fungus overlord.
Ooh.
So, most living things can easily surpass machines when it comes to navigating the real world environments and adapting to changing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
One way to bridge the gap is building biohybrid robots that merge synthetic machinery with biological components like animal muscles, bacteria, and plants. So when we did our man-made horrors beyond comprehension,
this is one of them.
We talked about this.
Yes.
You know, when they start putting rat tissue cells, rat heart tissue cells, with algae little stingrays,
mm-hmm.
so they would follow the light and stuff like that. But living muscles are very hard to keep alive in machinery. Bacteria have a very short lifespan, and plants tend to react to things too slowly. So that's why those groups of life aren't really good components.
Not the best.
Yeah. Like Terminator, you know, they showed it like once all the people realized what they do when they were in the robot or they were rotting inside the robot.
Oh, okay. You know? I understood. Yeah.
But yeah, so like Ents from Lord of the Rings. So some scientists at Cornell University went down a different path and started building biohybrid robots controlled by fungi. Specifically oyster mushrooms, species heavily commercially raised and eaten by humans. So understanding mushroom signals. Robots controlled by fungus, despite giving off strong Last of Us vibes, there is a good idea on the paper. Fungus are easily... Oh, sorry. This article is from... I didn't say it. Jackowa Koraki from September. Jackowa, I think Jackowi, something like that.
Okay. I might have to see it.
It's got a lot of Ks.
Okay.
Fungi are easily to sustain and can live pretty much anywhere, including extreme environments like the Arctic, and even among nuclear contaminants. Like we've talked about on the show, a lot of fungus like eating nuclear materials.
Yeah.
They don't get cancer. It's so weird, because the way that their cells work is very different.
And do we put them in that hole?
In what hole?
The nuclear waste hole that we just dump everything into?
They're there. We didn't put them there.
Oh, okay.
Like, they're in Chernobyl.
Well, good. They should be.
They're like on the elephant foot.
Yeah, we need them there.
Imagine going down there and just seeing a mushroom growing on the elephant foot. You know what that is, right?
The elephant foot mushroom? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, the elephant foot.
Oh, the elephant foot.
Well, in Chernobyl, it's the big like blob of radioactive material.
Yes. Yeah.
They're also cheap to culture in large quantities and excel at reacting to the environmental cues like exposure to light. So we've talked about they're much faster than mammals in processing information. So previously, the connection between fungi and the electrical machines have been done by imagine how rapid it grows. The new thing that we've done is to detect connections to the mycelial network, using it to control machines, says Robert F. Shepard, associate professor of mechanical engineering at Cornell University and co-author of the study. The mycelia are large networks of branching filament structures called hyphae, which are often located underground. Fungi use them to sense the environment, communicate with each other, and move around through electrical signals, like a nervous system. The track of interfering with mycelia with electrical systems into a culture is a 3D printed scaffold until it basically grows into the electronics after 14 to 33 days.
Mm.
So you build a machine like a skeleton
right.
for this fungus to grow into.
Grow on, yeah.
And it connects with the electrical circuitry.
Wow.
Making a stable connection is one thing. Reading its signals was quite another. The team recorded the electrical activity of the mushroom over 30 days, analyzed what they saw, and to start, the signals below 5 microvolts were classified as noise. The team simply had the data for 30-second intervals and applied it to a digital filter to smooth out everything below the 5 microvolts and remove any electrical noise. The way that it could previously identify, measure, and characterize peaks in the fungal electrical communication. Basically, like the synthesizers, when you plug them into mushrooms, there's a lot of background noise from it constantly doing stuff, like like an our nerve system. Our nerve system is never not firing. But when you yank your arm, that's a big jolt. So that's what they're basically saying, is it took 30 days, and they figured out what a baseline was, and they when they were wanting it to read the machine, they got rid of all the baseline stuff.
Gotcha.
So they could tell what a big, like a purposeful movement was. Once this was done, Shepard and his colleagues started the test of the fungi reacts to simple stimuli, like exposure to UV light at various intervals. When it was done, so they're torturing it. When it was done, the scaffolding and the fungal mycelia and electrodes were shielded from vibrations and magnetic interference and installed into two robots. A walking one resembling a starfish. The other one started a four-wheeler rover.
Okay. So they 3D printed this skeleton, grew the fungus on it.
And tortured it for a while.
And then installed it into these robots.
Yes. Yes.
To run them.
Yes. So still, that means the mushroom power control units and the shielding and the signal processing accounted just the are just what the dumbest off-the-shelf light sensor you could do. But fungi, apart from light, can react to chemicals. And in sensing chemicals, they beat pretty much every synthetic sensor on the planet.
Wow.
So what they're saying is basically putting them into the machines, they're about the simplest light sensor for the machine.
Okay.
But they're really good at chemical stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, they, like you said earlier, canary in the coal mines, they're thinking about using these for, like, whether it's radioactive materials or leaks or stuff like that.
Spills or something, yeah.
Stuff you can't smell or taste or see. Test for.
Yeah.
Like selenium's a bad one. Like selenium is, you know, deadly on the, we're talking about, you know, 1 billionth scale.
Oh, yeah.
The parts per billion, they're deadly.
Especially the aliens from whatever planet, you know, selenium. Very deadly.
Yeah. What is that?
The movie Evolution.
Evolution.
That's an evolution reference.
So they're using these guys. Okay. The fungal chemical detectors. The clear thing to do now is once you have a control system is looking for chemical exposure, biological exposures, living organisms can amplify these signals much better than any synthetic systems detecting very, very minuscule amounts of chemicals. When they're using fungi to, as chemical detectors, they would be way more challenging, because they entail matching electrical activity recorded to the fungal to the exposure of a wide catalog of chemical stimuli, like acidity to environmental pressures, specific chemicals, compounds like cyanide. The most likely way to get this done would be recording a large database of fungal electrical signals emitted in response to each exposure, emanating them, and then training AI models to interpret the fungal language.
Hmm.
Another thing with AI learning how a different thing speaks.
Speaks, yes. Another form of life's language.
So that was a lot of scientific mojo. Yes. They're going to torture a bunch of mushrooms to see what they react to different tortures. And then they're going to put them in robots and be like, and put them in torture situations.
Is this like a CIA funded project?
That's not. There's not that much torture.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, so it's just a Fauci edited project.
There you go. Closer.
Lots of torture.
A lot of things that kill mushrooms also kill plants, he added. The fungal botanic or biohybrid robots potentially use in aquaculture. We use such systems in connecting points, measuring the health of plants to avoid over-fertilizing fields. Imagine these little quadrupedal robots within feet laden with mycelia networks sensing and traversing the environment.
Jeez.
Over a mycelia overgrowth throughout entire field, and the robot just pokes its electrodes in the mycelia-rich environment to connect to it. So basically, to connect to different mycelia networks and talk to them to see what's going on in the field.
Who is funding this?
Cornell University is this one.
Okay.
Yes. So they put, remember, we talked about them putting mushrooms last when we did man-made horizontal comprehension, mushrooms into computers.
Right.
And now they're doing that with human brains and mushrooms in computers, in the same computer chips. And the mushrooms do much better than any electronical system. So now we're taking a step forward. We gave them access to the internet. They're going to judge us off of the internet,
which
is bad for the species.
Well, maybe.
And now we're putting off the internet?
Maybe.
Yes, it is.
Maybe it can connect the dots.
The internet is the worst of humanity.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. If you're judging humanity off of the internet.
Well, I mean, it might go a little deeper and judge the who are that are putting these awful things out there.
Remember, environmental engineers, they just get rid of the problem.
Right,
which is us,
well,
as a whole. That's what they would do.
I guess. Well, no, they if they're that intelligent, I think they could differentiate the difference.
They could, they won't.
See, I don't know.
And now we're putting them in the Boston Dynamic robots.
Yeah, those are awful.
But now they're controlled by mushrooms.
Yeah, okay, destroy them all. Burn everything. None of this stuff should exist.
Have you seen the starfish?
I have not seen the robot.
It moves around pretty quick. Jeez. The little four-wheeler moves around really fast, too.
Yeah, don't...
But it's being piloted by mushrooms.
Yeah, we don't need this stuff. This does not need to exist.
So this is a sign. What I'm getting at is basically, this is a thing that's not even an animal that has advanced amounts of intelligence maneuvering around. Basically, they move around underground very slowly. But given the body that they're forced to grow into, they can start piloting things.
Oh, man. It's just sad. This has bad news written all over it. What good can come of this?
This is probably what's piloting the drones in New Jersey.
Probably. It's fungus. It's
a big mushroom.
You're right. Harkening back to the living UFOs, they're all mushrooms.
They're all mushrooms. We're emulating them.
We're emulating them? What do you mean?
Copying.
Okay. Or emulating. Okay, gotcha.
That's what I said.
I'm sorry. It's just the dialect threw me off.
All right. So, I mean, yeah, it's crazy. It's really crazy. I don't know what to tell you more about this. That they gave mushrooms a robot to pilot.
You know what? Mushrooms should just be there for eating.
No. Just leave them alone.
No, let's eat them.
You're eating their sex organs.
You know what would taste good on a mushroom?
On a mushroom?
Yeah.
It's just their sex organs you eat.
Well, yeah, you got to fry it up. A little butter.
Oh, what would taste good on a mushroom?
Yeah, taste good on them.
I misunderstood.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what would taste good on them, eating them, would be just a little sprinkle of flavors of the forest.
We'll be back after this ad break. Jay, I maybe hooked up a cable to Bob the Giant Mushroom and maybe plugged it into my brain, and I was getting a very strong message.
What did he say?
He said Flavors of the Forest is coming out with a new flavor.
A new flavor?
Lion's Mane Mushroom. The ultimate thing to meld mushroom and the human brain together.
Wow.
It's coming. Bob the Giant Mushroom was telling me, everybody has to try this new flavor. Flavors of the Forest, Bigfoot Breath, Lion's Mane.
So this is something another food addition enhancer I can add to my food?
Lion's Mane, the superfood. The reproductive organ of the Lion's Mane Mushroom. Mm-hmm. Coming to Flavors of the Forest. Where can they be on the lookout for these new additions?
You can find this new additional flavor at flavorsforest.com/corn.
Be on the lookout for Bob and his kin.
You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIREST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Mushrooms,
delicious.
All right, so we've talked about whale intelligence. Okay, we've talked about mushroom intelligence. So these, at least in our circles that we've run, if you've been a long time listener to the show, you both know that those two groups of living things are highly intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are some of the groups you don't think of as intelligent?
Bugs.
Okay. Build off of it.
Bugs, insects, bacteria.
Arthropods. We'll just go arthropods in general.
Okay, spiders.
Which spiders fall under arthropods. So do crustaceans.
Ah, shrimps.
So what's something you've always heard about crustaceans, lobsters and crabs? Because they put them into pots of boiling water when they're alive.
Right, yeah.
And what do they always say about it? Do you remember?
Oh, the crabs and the lobsters? They say, ah!
Oh, no. What do the people say? Well, why is it okay to do that?
Oh, they say that they can't feel it, right?
They don't feel pain.
Yeah.
That's been said forever.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk about something horrible. If you're a big seafood eater, you should kill your crabs and lobsters first. And a lot of places are now. A lot of places are. They're humanely dispatching them.
That or put them in the freezer
first.
That's
a good way to do it, too. Yeah. So it's either slows down them basically till they die.
Yeah, shut off.
That's another humane way for like fish too. So like when we worked at fish hatcheries for food, they'll put them in literally an ice water slurry, and it slows down their metabolism till they basically pass out and they stop breathing.
Right. Yep.
So crabs and lobsters specifically have been thrown into pots of boiling water and other things while they're alive because people say they don't feel pain. This comes from. A lot of old studies done with their nervous system saying that they don't have the receptors for pain. I'm going to read you this thing that just came out literally in December this past year.
Oh, no.
That's a lie. Oh, it's a big lie.
Oh, no.
And people have known it for a long time. That's a lie.
Oh, no.
And they've been ignoring it.
So did they just create it just so you didn't feel so bad?
Yes.
Well, fair enough.
It talks about, I mean... You know, I'm a Christian. It talks about in the Bible not eating animals with their lifeblood in them, whether alive. You know, you're supposed to treat your animals that you eat even with a lot of respect.
Right.
Because you're eating them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a huge disrespect thing. But we used to do it because they're like, you know, because they're not alive. Now, I know even before this, a lot of places were starting to ban live lobsters and crabs.
Okay.
There's a lot of cruelty in the harvesting of lobsters and crabs. They're treated really, really rough from harvest to consumption, which is sometimes 3 or 4 months later.
Like you're talking about that tank at Red Lobster?
Yes. And then everything in between.
Oh, no.
So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going along with this. And it was because humans have this assumption of that crabs and lobsters look so alien that they can't be like us.
Right, yeah.
So scientists confirm crabs really can experience pain after all, just like a mammal.
Oh, great. Here we go.
So I want you to just think of a puppy the whole time I'm talking about this.
Okay. Thank you, by the way.
This is from Nature.
Thank you.
The website Nature.
Right, yeah.
By Carly Casarelli. It just came out in December. Crustaceans might put up a really hard exterior, but on the inside, they may be much more sensitive than often assumed. The first time scientists have shown that brain of the living shore crabs can process pain in neurological ways, depending on how sensitive and the location of harm. So they do have, you know, exoskeletons. So it's not like us with skin, right? We have external, you know, we have our skin on the outside full of nerve endings.
Right.
So we have a lot more fine touching. They do have exposed skin. But it's much like joints and around their face and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they're hard exoskeletons. It's much more like a turtle shell.
Right.
To where it's alive, but it's, you know, the nerve endings in it are dulled because it's exterior armor.
Right.
But, so yeah. The discovery leaves open the possibility that crabs and related crustaceans can experience pain very similar to how mammals and humans do. And while more research is needed, this means humans who boil or cut these crustaceans while they're alive could be causing undue harmful suffering. We need to find less painful ways, this is from the article writer, less painful ways to kill shellfish if we are going to continue to eat them. And this is actually a zoophysiologist, Liam Sheldon, of the University of Gothenburg, which I know in the UK, they're banning a lot of live shellfish at all.
Wow.
That they're going to start to be killing on the boat and stuff like that with ice baths and that kind of stuff.
Huh.
Because it's just not true. So what they did for these pain receptor areas is they used the face, the in-between the claws, the pinchers, there's a big piece of skin, the joints, and around the shell where the gill openings are.
Okay.
It's not great how they did this. They actually cut open the shell and put pain receptor, like basically neuroprobes, inside a crab, and then they tortured it.
Did they shock it or something?
They
or?
Stabbed it and shocked it and probed at it and stuff like that. And we started seeing very, very similar patterns that react to how mammals feel pain.
Yeah.
And neurological stresses and stuff like that, too. So scientists have long debated what it means to feel pain. In recent years, they've even so they've started finding pain receptors similar to mammals in fish, amphibians, and octopi.
Hmm.
So, because forever they were like, well, mammals are the only ones that experience pain the same, like how we experience pain.
I think it's just emotional pain.
Well, we start it went. We'll argue with that later.
No,
too.
I know. I think we can already confirm that's a lie.
So we had this whole thing that mammals were special, including like, we were on top of mammals. I mean, mammals were on top of every other animal.
Okay.
For you know, most of humans. Recent years, they've been studying amphibians that have social structures, fish that are hyper intelligent, and octopi are a whole nother level where thought they were aliens after we started studying.
Oh, yeah.
So we go in and in and in and start finding that those animals can sense pain. So finally, just this past year, they did crabs. And yeah, they sort of found it. So in the early years, for instance, a study found that shore crabs show the signs of anxiety in the face of electrical shocks and bright lights, learning to avoid the stimuli over time. So they can actually, like the, you know, torching the dog with the bell, feeding it, making it salivate kind of deal. So they started shocking a crab in the joint with a little electrical probe. But before that, they would shine a light.
Oh.
So then they started seeing after that, when the light would flick on, the anxiety hormones in the crab would shoot up.
Yeah.
So not only are they experiencing physical pain, they are experiencing psychological pain.
Wow.
That we are giving these crabs anxiety.
Wow.
And lobsters are, you know, still working on a lot of the other cousins. There's, like I said, there's just one species of shore crab, one of the most commonly, you know, eaten crabs in the world. So this is constitutes predictions that crustaceans can experience pain. But some skeptical sciences argue that this is merely a reflex. After even animals with basic nervous system can respond to painful stimuli and learn to avoid them, really part of survival. Now, here's where we start getting into it. The consciousness recognition of harm requires integration from a centralized nervous system, which researchers have now shown is possible in shore crabs.
Hmm.
So now we're showing that crabs not only experience pain, both physical and psychological, they may be conscious. And we talked about that a long time ago. What's it mean to be conscious?
Right, what does that mean?
Sapient and stuff like that. Crabs may be, in fact, conscious.
Sentient.
Well, there's a difference between sentientship and consciousness.
Right.
We are sentient. Your dog is kind of the borderline animal. And cows are conscious.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, it's hard. It's a really, really gray area kind of to define. Those are kind of the best animals. So crabs may be more akin to cows at their intelligent level.
Hmm.
Or other, you know, rabbits or whatever, any animal, any herbivore like that. So the activity of the crab's nervous system is monitored using instruments similar to electrocardiograph probes, EEGs, which, you know, you see on people's heads and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Except they had to cut open the crab's head and put it right on their brain.
Wonderful.
In case the electrodes are placed inside the crab shell. I love how scientists have to, like, okay. So, how do you want to guess how they tortured this crab to see if it could feel pain?
I mean, were they putting it in boiling water?
No, they didn't get that far. They shot vinegar in its face and its mouth and eyes.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Electrical stabs, all kinds of shockings and all kinds of stuff.
Bombardier beetles.
Yeah. So, this, they basically did this study. Basically, they got the complete opposite answer they thought they were going to get. This group of scientists did that. Not only do they experience pain on a certain level, they actually experience it very similar to some mammals. They actually can experience anxiety and long-term stress hormones.
Dang.
So crabs and lobsters in long-term shipping situations will actually stop eating, and we didn't know why. And it's because they start building up these stress hormones, same way mammals do. So the whole process that we've built around crustaceans, because we had this thought, this primitive idea that they didn't feel pain and they were very, very simple animals.
Right.
I'm not saying these guys have dreams or ambitions or anything like that.
But they might.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. But they experience pain. They experience anxiety. They experience long-term stress diseases, which is insane.
Right. I would have never imagined that before.
So what does this mean for cryptids? So we talk about like the giant Arkansas giant killer centipede.
Okay.
How can an animal be so big and not be found? If it experiences pain and anxiety and fear, it would eat like centipedes. And like we talked about in that episode, are naturally scared to death of primates.
Right, yeah.
They are naturally don't want to be, it don't matter about the size. You know, we talked about that with sturgeon, right? Mm-hmm. Sturgeon learn from a very long age, or when they're tiny, that they're prey animals.
Right.
Just because they get 8-10 foot long, now they still have that mentality. Mm-hmm. They're terrified of things.
Like, the instinct is still there.
So just because you got big, you're still scared of primates. And when we talk about the Arkansas giant killer centipede, all of the interactions with us primates were fearful.
Right.
It didn't hurt anybody until it was struck or shot at or hit with a stick. And the experiences that people walked away, it was acting defensively.
Yeah.
Like, hey, leave me alone. So now this study proves that arthropods as a whole, this is crustaceans, but we'll go arthropods as a whole, may be able to experience anxiety, fear, long-term pain, stress, but it may be flipped to the other side of it too.
Yeah.
They may experience happiness, or, you know, in a way, you know, maybe an alien version of it. We talk about with fungus,
mm-hmm.
you know, it may be a very alien version of that emotion or that feeling. But it's a chemical thing, you know?
I bet it's not. I mean, everything has its opposite, everything in nature.
But we can test for the one. It's harder to test for the
right,
other.
Right.
So these crabs may be able to feel happy, maybe able to feel joy in a way.
Right, yeah.
Maybe, you know, when it gets its favorite food. I follow a guy that has a blue crab and a lobster as a pet. He's a big aquarium guy.
Uh-huh.
And they have to be in their own tanks because crustaceans.
They'll eat each other.
Well, that, and they don't do well with fish for the fish's sake and stuff like that. They're very food driven. But he talks about how excited and you can watch videos of it. Look up, I can't remember if her name's Sally the Blue Crab or something like that. But when she sees certain food, she gets so excited, she'll start doing like little flips and going up the corners of the tank and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
Which you could say is food aggression, or you could say it's excitement. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I there's no really way, I think, to prove
to
that.
To measure it, yeah.
Without cutting her skull open or you know, it's putting probes in her brain.
Let's do that, yeah.
Scientists will.
I know. And put them in a box with sand, or was it sand fleas? Flies?
No, sand. Yeah, sand fleas.
Yeah, just cover their head in it. Yeah, while they're alive.
But that thing gets excited. You know, it loves sweet corn.
Mm.
And the guy hates feeding her sweet corn because it makes a huge mess in the aquarium.
Oh, okay.
So every time she sees a half cob of sweet corn, she starts doing these flips and getting really excited. So crustaceans may be able to experience excitement and joy and pleasure.
Yeah.
And crabs, so there's a type of, I think they're red reef crabs or red spike crabs, something like that, that do this giant migration in the ocean to molt. They're huge sea crabs. They do this giant migration of molt. And National Geographic has done videos of them, and they did the camera thing with it.
Hmm.
Why do they do this? Why do they migrate to one area to molt every year? It's because when they molt, they're extremely vulnerable. No, so they're soft-shelled. So they're only defensive organ. You know, the only thing they have to defense is gone. So during these molten things, these giant, and I'm talking 700-800-pound stingrays come. And they can't really handle the crabs that can defend themselves. But what they're trying to do is slurp up the soft-shelled crabs.
Mm.
So what do these crabs do? The notorious crab mentality, except it's the opposite. Where the crabs that are molting, they put on the bottom of the pile. And the crabs that either have molted or have not molted yet
are on top.
So they did this with a camera, and it's one of the probes that was a soft shell crab, and literally dozens of these crabs start covering it up to protect it from the stingray, and they're pinching at the stingray and everything like that. So there's something there.
Yeah.
You know, it may be, it's alien to us because they're so vastly different than us.
Right. Yeah.
But then when you start peeling it back, they're very similar.
Right. Yeah. We all have the same qualities at the core.
So yeah. What'd you think of that one?
That's pretty wild. I mean, and feel bad for all those lobsters and crabs that get tossed in alive, but
don't do it.
Yeah. That's,
it's a super, the oh, crustacean thing, the harvesting of crustaceans is super horrible the whole way through.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you shouldn't eat crabs or lobsters. I don't care.
Oh, they taste great.
I eat chickens and I love chickens. I mm-hmm. think chickens are really intelligent. I still eat them. But you got to be respectful and understand.
Yeah, I think
you don't torture food.
That's the
you
important
don't torture
takeaway.
Animals that you're going to eat. Like, It's
not good for you anyways. If you eat that tortured food, I mean, that stress is in the meat. You are consuming that energy. It happens. You are what you eat. It's just what it
Let's
is.
Let's talk about another really alien group to mammals as okay. a whole.
Oh, I was just going to say real quick. Now I feel bad when I – remember when Meyer used to have the lobster tank?
Oh, yeah, I seen you write that down.
Yeah, the Meyer lobsters. Good old days. I haven't seen that in – I don't think that's a thing anymore.
No, because it got outlawed.
That's why.
Because they were staying in there too long. It was cruel.
Well, I'll tell you what, as a kid, though, that was the most exciting part of the grocery store.
Walmart
had the lobsters too?
Yes.
Dang.
There was a big tank in that little back corner where the seafood aisle is now.
Yep.
At least in our local Walmart. And we always loved seeing him. I didn't know. You didn't know. Yeah. Nobody knows. You know, you don't know until you hear about it.
Oh, yeah. But I love seeing him.
I was excited. There was a lady from Indian Lake, Ohio, that would buy one a week and release it into Indian Lake.
There's no way it lived.
She didn't understand that.
Oh, okay.
She felt bad for them. But yeah. She would save up money and once a week and go buy one to free. And then it died in Indian Lake.
Yes.
There was a very happy catfish down there.
There you go. Yeah. Hey.
Lobster dinner.
Poor tortured lobsters. Let's feed them to a catfish.
So let's talk about another group of animals that doesn't get viewed as intelligent or emotional or anyway. Let's talk about fish.
Okay.
And we're going to talk specifically about the striped marlin.
Okay.
So you know what a marlin is, right?
Yes, I do.
Swordfish.
Yep.
A type of swordfish. These guys can get up to 12 feet long and 450 pounds, which is very large.
Striped marlin?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very large, but not for the marlin group.
Okay.
They're bigger than most sailfish, which have the big sail on top. But they're not like blue marlin and black marlin get thousands of pounds, you know.
Okay.
These guys get about 500. Pretty much anywhere in tropical warm waters in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. They're recognized for their blue and black stripes and these white patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Look really neat.
We just found out this past year and a half that they have language. And we use drones to do it. So these guys move about 50, 60 miles an hour when they're hunting. And for years, we couldn't figure out how they coordinate attacks. So there'll be schools of them slamming into these balls of bait fish and killing bait fish to eat.
Mm-hmm.
We never seen one stab into another one. Keep in mind, these guys are flying in and going into these bait balls blind.
Okay.
So they run into each other. They kill other animals. Sometimes they'll contact with seals and other things and kill them. So why aren't they doing it to each other? We couldn't figure it out forever.
Okay.
So they started following these schools of these striped marlin with drones overhead, way up. And we found something amazing. The stripes change rapidly. They have chromatophores in their skin, basically, and they change their stripes to talk to each other, to tell them what they're doing.
Huh.
So, and we just now started doing this.
We never caught this before?
No, because they move so fast.
Okay, makes sense.
They're moving 50, 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So imagine trying to study a car on the highway.
Oh, true.
You know, but it's, you know, it's constantly moving. So we started using drones, and you could see, and now there's AI models that are predicting what the marlin's going to do, because it's starting to read the color patterns, and it's accurate. So these marlin are using each other to push these balls of bait tighter and communicating who's running in, who's doing what, flank left, do all these crazy movements and motions with fast flashing color patterns.
Scale patterns.
Yeah, no, it is. It's skin patterns. It's okay. You know. So they're communicating constantly.
Huh.
Isn't that crazy?
I didn't know fish could like flash colors like that.
Oh, a bunch of them can.
Oh, okay. I guess I just thought that
some are much better at it than others.
I guess you're right. Yeah, I was thinking more like cephalopods doing that more than
they. Oh, they do it. I mean, that's my next one. But they do it. You know, they're extreme.
Right.
You
know, right. For sure. Yeah.
These guys can flash colors, and we don't know. Like you said, the patterns mean a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And there was an episode of The Future is Wild after humans go extinct and what animals take shape.
Yep.
And they actually talked about. Marlin doing this a long time ago. They didn't know, like, we didn't know how complex it was, but they talked about maybe them flashing skin colors and actually communicating and becoming a social fish. They already are a social fish.
They're already doing it.
And we don't know, like I said, we have this idea of amphibians and fish and arthropods even not having any higher mental functions. And that's starting to melt away. You know,
we're starting to peel back.
Anybody that's been around and worked with those animals knows that's not fully true.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, they're nowhere. I guess when you talk about social skills as a primate, you know, it's still up there with a whale, you know, with animals that have high social structures and big cats and stuff like that. But now we're starting to see tons and tons more animals that are able to communicate and act in these big groups.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So what do you think about striped marlin?
That's pretty awesome discovery.
Now, I'm just going to do two more for you. We're at an hour already.
Okay.
My second to last one is octopus and groupers. So there's a species of reef octopus and potato groupers that live on these coral reefs.
Ah, okay, yes.
We've talked about this before, but I want to bring this up.
Yep.
So this is the ability for interspecies communication. So these are two animals that are not related to each other whatsoever.
At all.
These aren't two fish talking. These aren't two octopus talking. These are a group of potato groupers will often follow one of these giant reef octopus. So what they found out, and they both can kill each other. They're both prey items to each other. They're both apex predators, so they shouldn't like each other. But these groups of these animals, they'll have four or five groupers to one big octopus, and they'll follow each other. And how do they communicate? Well, a long time ago, so we don't know when or how, but they both change skin color to talk.
Hmm.
So either the grouper picked up on the octopus doing it, or vice versa, which is probably more likely.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And started mimicking their language.
Yeah.
But the grouper was then smart enough to realize that the octopus is talking back.
Yeah.
So what they'll do now is they hunt in groups, and they will hop along the reef, and the potato groupers will push schools of fish into a piece of coral or whatever, and they'll just sit there and wait. The octopus will then go into the coral and flush all the fish back out to the potato grouper.
Mm-hmm.
So they both catch food during this.
Right, yeah.
And it seems to be lifelong relationships. So octopus don't live that long. They die during the reproductive cycle, but it even seems to be followed on genetic family lines. That the octopus, like we talked about, they have a lot of genetic knowledge. So they pass down a lot of stuff. So their offspring know how to communicate with this local group of groupers.
Which is crazy to think about.
So, you know, the grouper may not know that it's a different octopus because, I mean, you know, it's smaller now, but it'll grow fast. But these interspecies communication, this animal, I mean, people look at groupers like these big, dumb potatoes, and they're really called potato groupers, these big, dumb things. And they're talking to octopuses, you know, an animal that's highly regarded as probably
one of the smartest
animals on the planet.
Exactly.
And they're sitting there. We don't know. It's maybe a more dog and human relationship.
Yeah.
Or it could be a more mutual. I don't know. We know. Nobody knows. Nobody will ever.
No.
Because fish, the idea of fish and arthropods being any kind of intelligent is just now starting to be looked into. Like I said, they're being surprised constantly. Like, they just found out lobsters have anxiety from people.
Right. Ain't that nuts? That should be the headline of the article.
That may be the name of the episode.
Yeah.
Lobster anxiety. Now, I mean, what do you think of that one?
I know we've talked about it before, but it's pretty awesome. It's cool seeing that interspecies relationship, you know, working together.
And it's not like, so there's like...
It's neat.
Badgers and coyotes will do this.
Mm-hmm.
But those are both mammals.
Right,
vocalizations. Yeah. They communicate similar ways.
Yeah, too. This is across the, I guess...
A vertebrate and an invertebrate.
Yeah, very, very, very...
Technically a mollusk and a vertebrate.
Very, 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 very different.
I mean, it'd be harder. They both live in the ocean, I guess. I guess it's
about the only thing that relates them together.
Yeah. One has arms and section up, so one has fin. They're crazy different. My last one for you is another one we've talked about. If you remember the Mongolian death worm episode from like season one or two.
Okay.
Velvet worms.
Oh, yeah. I remember them.
Ancient. So the idea of maybe even intelligence being on the end of an evolutionary line is off, too.
Okay.
Because these guys have been the same thing as far as conventional time scaling goes for about 350 million years.
Okay. That's quite a long time.
Yeah. So if anybody hasn't seen Velvet Worm, imagine a gummy worm and a centipede had a baby.
Fair.
That's pretty accurate. Most of them are pretty small. Some of them get up to 4 or 5 inches long. I think 10 inches is about the biggest. They have a small pair of retractable claws on the end of each foot. They have they operate in little, like liquid hydraulics is how they move around. They're basically octopus if an octopus could walk around.
Okay.
They are incredibly simple organisms.
Aren't they very colorful?
Depending on the species. Okay. Some species are brown, you know, but some of the tropical ones can be very colorful. Like I said, most velvet worms, like 2 to 3 inches long. The biggest species is 8 to 10 inches long. But some of them are very colorful. They have a pretty cuddly appearance. Do not touch them.
No, yes.
They actually have little glands on the side of their head. They shoot stringy acid.
Out of their... Yeah.
So these little guys have been seen to have complex social structures. They hunt in packs with the only thing a lot of biologists compare them to with how advanced the hunting techniques are is African lions.
Jeez.
So they take down prey many, many times bigger than themselves. They act like African lions.
And they're worms.
And we don't know how they're communicating. We don't know how they're coordinating pack attacks. We have no idea. They're not worms. They're much more older.
Infrasound.
Yeah. It could be something. It could be sound. I have no idea. Nobody knows. But these guys hunt in packs. And then they have a hierarchy in the social structure of who eats first. These are velvet worms. 350 million years ago. They haven't changed. They've rocked every mass extinction.
So something. It's a good body plan, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Just like, every time I see them white, I'm all right. Ain't nobody got to worry about me when they're crawling.
Oh, gotcha.
That's the music playing in the background. Because they don't care. But no. So this is an animal that you could barely see for some of the species that is revered as ancient and incredibly simple. A body plan of early life on the planet has extremely high social structures, hierarchies inside the pride, and hunts in coordinated levels that's only comparable to African lions.
That's insane.
So why did I do all this? To show you guys something. That intelligence, because we get asked a lot, how is Bigfoot smart enough to hide?
Right.
Which is theoretically a primate or a higher mammal or whatever. How is Bigfoot smart enough to hide from us?
Right.
How is there any kind of animal in the environment that's that intelligent?
Wait, you know, it's that big, and I hunt all my life. How have I? And I've never seen one.
Yeah, I mean, hundreds of times a year we get said that to that. Not to dog anybody. I get it. And if you don't know. You don't know.
Right.
But animals as a whole are vastly more intelligent and complex than anybody gives them credit for. Even fungus, which aren't animals, but they're not plants, their own thing, are so much more complex than anybody gives them credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just now getting to the start of realizing that what we quote-unquote call simpler organisms, like arthropods and fish,
may not be so simple after all.
They may not be simple. I mean, the velvet worm's a proof of concept that just because your body plan is quote-unquote simple, your family order is ancient.
Right.
Doesn't mean you haven't figured out how social structures. We don't know. Reptiles have social structures.
They're not simple. They're efficient.
That's what I didn't put on here is the monkey tail skink, which is the as far as communally known right now, is the only social reptile. They actually live because they live on an island where they're the biggest thing, where they act like monkeys. They have mom and dads. They mated for life. They raise a young. They teach one young at a time how to live and exist until they're old enough to go off on their own. They do it again. In captivity, I hate it. These are, like, once again, the idea of reptiles being dumb. Modern lizards are incredibly complex. They're up there with cats in their ability to reason, think, and hunt. So they need stimuli. So they put them in these dumb reptile enclosures, and they don't get anything.
Dulls their senses.
You would go to jail putting cats in the enclosures that we put modern lizards into.
Mm-hmm.
But these monkey tail skinks have incredibly high anxiety levels when they're by themselves. They want other members of their species. They're highly social. They live in larger family groups, and then they live in larger social groups.
Wow, okay.
So when we just put one in a tank...
By himself, isolated.
It's like putting a social monkey in a tank by itself.
Yeah.
They're going to... I mean, the monkey would kill itself eventually.
Put them in solitary, basically.
I mean, they go nuts.
Yeah.
And then they start acting like a wild, like a crazy animal because they're nuts.
Mm.
So this whole episode is to show you that cryptids can be hyper-intelligent, can hide around people, can have developed social structures down to the invertebrate level.
Right.
That if they don't want to be found or they have any reason to be scared of people, they're not going to be found.
And these were all examples you can point your finger at in the natural and nature right now that can escape us. That is smart enough. That is intelligent. We didn't know before.
What was your favorite animal of this group?
Probably the most surprising is going to be the lobster thing. And
isn't that horrible? Think about the lie.
It is. I know. Because I'm telling you, I really look forward going to Red Lobster and looking at them.
I'm not saying
tank.
You shouldn't eat them. I'm just saying.
No, I still want to eat them.
The torturing of them needs to stop.
The way in which we cook them.
All those people, the kids go up to the tanks and say they look sad. These people that say, no, they don't have any emotions. And then now
the kids are right.
Oh yeah, the kid is right. They could see the pain in their eyes.
And just their body language.
We'll go out on a joke that there's two lobsters sitting in a tank on a boat.
Okay.
Okay. The one lobster looks over to the other one and is like, I can't wait to see my wife and kids again. And he's like, Terry, it's not looking good. And he's like, I just got a feeling it's gonna all work out. You zoom out and the ship's the Titanic.
Oh. Okay, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah. It worked out.
Yeah, it did, didn't it?
Mm. All right. I have been the great and powerful mystery.
I have been J-Clone 19.
We'll catch you next week, guys.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Thank you for listening to Cryptids of the Corn podcast. Remember, the best way to support the show is share it with a friend. But if you are craving more of the J-Clones
and more from Mr. E,
there's always extra content on Patreon
and our paid member space on cryptidsofthecorn.com.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting, fun, and informative information.
Bye! Bye.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.